Good evening to you, and welcome to the show, History and You, with George Rodriguez Walling.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to History and You, the show where you decide what history becomes. I am your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I am very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts, please do so at toll-free 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Call me and tell me your views. If not, just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find me at bbsradio.com/historyandyou. Please remember to visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube links found on the website as follow-up to each and every program. I'd like to take a moment of silence for the innocent people who were killed and those who were severely injured in the Boston bombing yesterday. May God be with them in silent memory. Okay, very well. Tonight's topic, Veteran Benefits, a Practical Primer. It wasn't long after 9/11 occurred in 2001 that my wife and I went out to dinner to one of our local and favorite restaurants here in town. No sooner did we walk in, I caught sight of a Marine in uniform sitting in a corner table with his family. I left my wife's side for a moment and walked over to him. I excused myself for interrupting his meal. I extended my hand to shake his in gratitude for what guys like him do for people like us. And I left. It was as simple as that. I felt good about what I did, because in every war, as with every crisis, our military picks up a weapon and stands a post to keep all of us secure, to enjoy the life we live here in the States. And I'm equally confident to say that it's always been that way, too. Now, whether that Marine that night thought I was stupid, eccentric, or a bit off balance from the conventional scales is entirely up to him to decide at the moment. But as I said, I felt good about what I did because of my respect for what they do. War is a nasty business that nobody, and I mean nobody, could ever imagine unless you've been there to experience it for yourself. From the moment you start your basic training all the way through to fighting the enemy in the battlefield, saving your buddy's life and getting wounded in the process, your chopper ride back home is getting you ready to take care of you, or so you may think, with their hospital treatments and medical benefits. And it's right to come and expect it. After all, you did do your duty and offered your life for the service of a country you believe in deeply. Soldiers in the field must be given the respect they deserve. This is why, for me, it was inconceivable to see how Vietnam veterans would come back to the States only to be showered with insults and spit, instead of saluted and publicly respected for doing their duty. I also think that along the way, America learned a redefinition of democracy and how carefully crafted American foreign policy became in subsequent military conflicts since Vietnam. A war well fought, regardless of circumstances in battle or outcome, a returning veteran is one of us. And he must be taken care of in the same way we care for the sick, the disabled, or otherwise infirmed, for whatever reason. My guest this evening is a 100% disabled veteran and a retired attorney who has worked tirelessly with the VA system for over 20 years. As it became clear that many applicants failed to qualify for benefits due to a misunderstanding of the system regarding its operation, this gentleman decided to write a guide that simplifies the entire process. The name of this guide is called the Veterans Practical Primer. Also a radio talk show host for just over 20 years, as well as an author of 57 books to his credit already. Ladies and gentlemen, it's with great pleasure that I do present Mr. Ken Hudnall. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Well, thank you.
Okay, Ken, let's talk a bit in more detail. What exactly is a Veterans Practical Primer, and what does it offer?
Well, the Veterans Practical Primer is a how-to. It takes you from step one, and step one is actually before you leave service. There's a lot of things you need to do, a lot of material that you need to have prepared to help you with that transition.
Give me an example, Ken, of what might be one of the first things you need to do just before you leave the service.
Well, number one, the best soldier makes the worst veteran, because the best soldier doesn't get medical care in the military like he should. Instead, he's carrying out his duties. One of the things the VA looks at is how much medical care did you get for your problem while on active duty. If very little, then that you're penalized. So you need to make sure that during that last period, I always say 6 months, any problem you've had, you get it examined and you get it documented. Now, you'll be able to apply for your initial disability rating while you're still on active duty. My initial rating was 10%, because like a good soldier, I mean, I was a captain. I was supposed to set the example. I didn't go get treatment when I should have. I put it off until there was nothing going on. And
nobody around was informing you of what you had to do, or nobody around was pointing the way for you?
Oh, good Lord, no. It was those that were doing the briefings when you got ready to out-process, it was almost an additional duty for them, and you had to get time off from your regular job to go to the briefings and understand how the system worked. Now, the reason it took me 20 years to get my 100% rating, I had been told before leaving active duty that I would be in a wheelchair by the time I was 26. I was 24, almost 25 at that time. But part of the problem was the Army had misdiagnosed my condition, and they didn't want to admit it, because the Army does, at least at that time, did not want to take responsibility for sloppy medical care.
Now, when you talk about that time, are you talking about the era of Vietnam?
Generally, yes. It was 1980. When I ETS'd, the doctor who did my out-processing physical didn't even annotate that I was on crutches the day I got the physical. According to him, I was just a picture of health. And I applied. I said, look, with this problem, I should be going in front of a board where the doctor says that you're wonderful. And that's when I learned about Army doctors.
Well, Ken, isn't there any kind of monitoring or oversight or supervision on these doctors, or the whole program contingent to their funding, that would make it more of a competent practice instead of such a reckless and arbitrary one?
At the time... now, it's changed some since, but at the time, I fought this all the way up to the director of medicine for the Army, because I was questioning this man's competence. And he said, look, do you know what it takes to practice medicine for the Army? And I said, actually, no. And nobody else seems to either. Certification from this department that you are a competent physician. He said, I could give it to you, and you could go practice medicine in the military. And I said, that's insane. And he said, I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. I discovered the doctor in question probably was not a licensed physician. Now, he was licensed here, but his so-called medical training may not have been to the standards of this country. He was Romanian. He had served in the Romanian Iron Guard during World War II. He was captured. He was placed in a Russian POW camp. He treated German general officers and senior officers of his country. And when he got sprung 10 years later, our CIA snapped him up because he knew all about the Russians. He was brought here under Operation Paperclip, asked what he wanted to do. He said, I want to practice medicine. He practiced medicine.
He had been bounced out of. Was he getting paid under the table?
Well, they gave him credentials that let him practice in the civilian world until he got run out of every hospital he ever practiced at. Even with a federal court finding that he was incompetent in his own specialty, ears, nose, and throat, he was hired to work for the U.S. Army, and he, according to what I was told, he had been instrumental in the death of a child, so they put him to doing physicals where they figured he couldn't hurt anybody.
That's incredible. I know from the information, some of the information you gave me, that the VA is behind in this application. How is it possible the VA is almost 2 million applications behind from
they
the
are just overwhelmed.
Wars?
They're just overwhelmed.
But if you can put your finger on something, about what might one or two or three things be that attributes to that situation?
Because every entity within the system builds its own empire. They very jealously guard their own records. You would think in this day and age of computers that you could go on a computer, put in my information, and pull up every record about me in the federal government. That's not the case. That is not the case.
Whoa.
And the first form you do is you fill out a form with the VA that outlines what you think your problems are. We have soldiers that filling that form out is a complete and total mystery.
Well, you told me that if a form is not properly filled out, then it just doesn't go anywhere. So, what do you mean exactly if a form is not properly filled out? What has to happen or not happen?
Well, number one, your name, as the Army has it, which is not always the way you think your name is. Your Social Security number. I've seen cases where soldiers have inverted numbers inadvertently. What your problem is. Now, understand, the VA... We look at an agency that is staffed by veterans to help veterans. That quit being the case a long time ago. A lot of people get to positions of authority in the VA through civil service promotions. Some of them have never, ever heard a shot fired in anger.
Okay.
They don't understand.
Now, wait a minute. Just a second. Are you telling me that veterans with the experience and the competency that came from this experience – was substituted by people that knew how to pass a test of competency?
Yes. Now, the law says that if a returning veteran is entitled to a position, that's what the law says. The way it is actually applied, according to the situation that I ran into, is that just gets you a leg. You get an extra 10 points. It's called 10-point preference. You get an extra 10 points in applying for the job. And the way it's applied by the VA, it doesn't get you the job. It just gets you the chance to compete against other people. I was competing against two people I'd been doing public affairs for a major corporation for several, many, many years. I was up against two ladies who came out of civil service, had never been associated with the military, but they were friends of the selecting official. And when the selecting official walked in the room, her first words to me is, I prefer to work with the female, you know.
Naturally,
now, that, is, that of course, is discrimination. However,
Of course.
So And the government has a law that says if you're a disabled veteran, they can actually just say, okay, that desk is yours, go to work. But they won't use it. We've got so many non-veterans working in the VA system, and to them, it's a job.
Yeah, naturally.
They don't get, and it when 5 o'clock comes, they're out the door. Well, that's not the way you need to deal with the veterans, and that's why so many veterans are disgusted with the system. In this town, we've got about 70,000 veterans. About a third of them will not even apply for their benefits because they don't want to fight the paper monster. That's why I wrote the book.
Well, Ken, let me ask, has new legislation been introduced to change this morass of this process?
Legislation, very little. I designed a system that would actually do it, and I'm having to literally fight the system to present the new system. Because you are going, if they agree with me, their brother-in-law may not be able to get a job at the VA, or their sister-in-law may not be able to get a job. My wife went out there and applied as a dietitian. She's been rated the best one in the state of Texas. She couldn't even get an interview because she didn't know the right people. She was using my 10-point preference. That didn't even get her an interview.
Jesus. Well, Ken, let me ask you, to what extent do you blame the Obama administration for doing nothing to improve the dissemination of veteran benefits?
The Obama administration didn't have a prayer because they went in and treated it as something that could be fixed by changing directors. Eric Senseiki is the director right now.
Yeah.
Very pro GI. I knew him many moons ago. But you can't treat it like you would your standard government agency. You've got one of the largest healthcare systems in the world being run like a standard hospital. If the forms aren't filled out right, if the I's not dotted, if the T's not correct. When I was trying to get my benefits, I live in El Paso. Waco is our regional office. I was sent to Albuquerque because I had spent 6 months living in Albuquerque. So I was told to go over there. They had my records. I got misdirected, walked into an office where there's a bunch of people are diligently shredding papers. And I sat down on the corner of the desk waiting on somebody to pay attention to me, and I glanced at what they were shredding, and it was some of my medical records. And I said,
why?
Guys, because of the misdiagnosis, they had never bothered to check what the Army did. And it suddenly came to light, and it was like, oh, God, we got to fix this. And I said, well, guys, you can shred this to your heart's content, but I got the originals. And they realized who I was, and mass panic broke out.
Jeez.
We since got everything straightened out, but we got it straightened out only because, I firmly believe, only because I'm an attorney. Now, I wound up in front of a hearing in Washington, D.C., they appointed somebody to represent me because I was clearly too dumb to represent myself. And the young man meant well, had the best intentions in the world, but he was scared of the judge. And I finally asked the judge, could I say a few things? And he said, well, that's how they are regular. He said, why do you want to say anything? And I said, with all due respect, this young man beside me is so damn dumb, he has no idea what we're even here for. Well, do you think you can represent yourself? I said, have you bothered to read my file yet? What are you referring to? I said, look under education. He looked at it and said, oh. Stopped the hearing, referred everything back to the region, and said, you people get with him and get this fixed. Now, all that procedure cost me several years of VA benefits.
How long did it take you to write up the whole primer?
The primer took me about 8 months. Now, the VA does have all that information out there in the electronic world. And if you can understand it, you're doing better than most people I know. I took it and I put it into English, and it so offended the VA that I actually had them ban that book from the local VA facility.
Oh, my God. Ken, let me ask you another question that is changing gears slightly, but I do want to get this in because you are a military man as well as a man of the legal profession, obviously. What is your opinion of our current state of military readiness?
Militarily, the boots on the ground, we are a match for anybody. However, it is the politicalization of the military that I think is going to be our downfall. I came up during a period of time where Vietnam was kind of an aberration at the time, where senators and congressmen tried to run it. But the generals ran the army. And yet, a lot of what I'm seeing today, a lot of what we're seeing in Afghanistan, because I've done voiceovers for a lot of the news shows. I'd called it the infantry school, so I wrote some of the tactics they're still using, and I wrote those tactics 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if you go to fight a war and those are your enemies over there, you don't concern yourself about the political niceties. You go in to win a war. We won the war, and then we started playing politics. Karzai is dictating, for all practical purposes, dictating to us what we're going to do. Yes, it's his country, but if we walk away, his life expectancy is about 45 minutes. We're more concerned about what everybody thinks than what's right and what we ought to do.
You know, definitely. I think that what you're saying has a lot of validity to it in terms of the politics. But then, then again, politics has always been part of the whole military process, particularly I can think back to Johnson trying to have a very, very long hand in the whole Vietnam scenario. But with all of that, we're facing somewhat of a new phenomenon for a lot of people, perhaps not yourself with the military experience that you have, but to a lot of people, urban warfare is something new. It's something that can be perceived as very threatening. Should there be an alert out there for urban warfare?
Oh, Lord, yes. In fact, my specialty in the military was urban warfare and counterterrorism. And I've watched this country appoint terrorism czars who never heard a shot fired, but they are politically close to the president, therefore they get the nod. We've got Napolitano running Department of Homeland Security, who at one point in time said returning veterans should be considered potential terrorists, And now, please. The only thing she knows about a terrorist is she prosecuted McVeigh. Is every single veteran a potential Timothy McVeigh? I would say no.
I would agree.
However, does every potential terrorist have the skills to do something like that? About 25% of them. Because there's other things in the military besides being on the ground. I wound up finishing my career in the legal field. I was an infantry officer for a good many years. My specialty was going in and making things that used to stand up, lay down. And it was an interesting transition. We also have the problem of the way you have to think to survive, and then you come back to the States and we're expected to flip a switch and change it overnight.
Exactly. Is there a difference between fighting a terrorist and a guerrilla tactics specialist? Guerrilla fighting and terrorism, is it one and the same, or are they two distinctly different things?
They are alike and they're different. A terrorist has, nine times out of ten, a political agenda. A guerrilla is oriented more toward being in the field, military tactics. The terrorist is going to take what he wants to do and put it in a semi-political frame. You know, assuming that it was terrorism at the Boston Marathon.
Yeah.
That would be a semi-political act because you're affecting the body politic in what was done. If it was a guerrilla war, then literally you got a war. It's just an ununiformed group of people you're up against. There's some similarities and there's some differences.
Yeah.
Perhaps the differences are just philosophical, but their difference is none the same.
Yeah. Well, in the wake of obviously the Boston bombing, which occurred yesterday, and watching the news, you can't help but to be filled with dismay with a lot of people that are really unfamiliar with the differences between the two. And I can understand how a lot of people might be confused by trying to draw the differences between these two styles of fighting. And this is the reason why I had to ask that question to you, a person of your kind of experience. But all of this is very, very interesting for all of us to hear. But let's take a quick break right now, and we'll be right back with Mr. Ken Hudnall and Veteran Benefits, a Practical Primer, in just a moment. Okay, we're back with Mr. Ken Hudnall discussing tonight's topic, Veteran Benefits, a Practical Primer. We just got through having, just before commercial break, a very, very enlightening distinction, discussing the differences between guerrilla warfare tactics and terrorist fighting, which I think a lot of people are not necessarily enlightened about or really can appreciate the differences between the two. But Ken did say something that was very, very true. The terrorist does carry a political agenda all the way to its radical end, while the guerrilla fighter, his leader will carry that political agenda, but not necessarily his guerrillas, which is very, very true. But Ken, at this time, let me go back to the very alarming situation of the VA, which you have been so incredibly instrumental so far in clarifying the whole process for a lot of these vets that come home and really don't know what to do with themselves, let alone what to do with the system and trying to gain some kind of an assistance. But my next question to you is, what happens to all of these vets who do not apply for VA benefits because the system is so complicated? Where do they go for assistance?
Literally, there's no place they can go.
Oh, Jesus.
I mean, if you're entitled to benefits and you don't apply for them, then that's like, if you come down to my dealership, I'll give you a free car. You don't ever go, you don't get the car.
Yeah.
See, a lot of people look – I had one gentleman argue with me for 45 minutes that applying for VA benefits was wanting charity. That's the furthest thing from the truth, because you earn those benefits. Your agreement with the government when you went in was that when you come out, you have XYZ in the way of VA benefits. But trying to convince a lot of people of that can be – problematic.
Yeah, and of course the VA benefits here can also include housing benefits as well, right?
Yes. Housing loans. I mean, in this day and time when you've got to have 20% down on a mortgage with a VA loan, you put nothing down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interest rates are low. And the VA will, if you have a problem and you're on the verge of of foreclosure, the VA can actually step in and rearrange things for you.
Yeah. Well, that's reassuring if you can get your name right and your Social Security number right on the application, I guess. Is there a veteran discrimination out there for vets getting jobs, Ken?
Oh, Lord, yes. I'm under Chapter 31, which is voc rehab. The government thought I was having too much fun harassing them with my show, so they sent me back to school. And even at the university, I'm running into a lot of disabled veteran and or just veteran discrimination.
Well, so I mean, what are people thinking, that you're sitting out there drinking up all your pension for the rest of your life and not doing anything and residing on the welfare state? Is that what people are thinking?
Pretty much. That seems to be the case.
So the job market out there for vets is very, very limited.
Well, I told you what happened when I applied within the VA itself for a job that I had done for over 7 years.
Yeah,
the individual making a selection was not a veteran, and she wanted some of her friends to have the job.
Yeah, usually cronies and nepotism always seems to find its way to pervade. If you don't know, if you don't have Uncle Buck there working as your immediate supervisor, then you're out of luck.
Exactly.
Yeah. My God.
Now, there's a scandal going on here right now regarding the VA, and he was my former primary physician. He was arrested by the feds because he wasn't seeing his VA patients. Instead, he was going to little clinics he set up in three or four states and giving out pain medication at $400 a prescription.
Yeah, and they're so quick to point that out, but other lackeys in other parts in the VA system, those they decide to turn their heads and turn away from it.
They stay hidden as long as they want to.
All right, now I'm going to lay something a little bit stronger on you, Ken, and I want to see how you respond to this. Is there some kind of a conspiracy on the part of the VA to marginalize veterans by showing reluctance to explain the application process more clearly? Sort of like, if you don't explain it very well, maybe most of them will just go away.
If you'll remember back to the Reagan years, and unfortunately, I remember it very well, which shows how old I am. He said, if you turn folks down the first time, half of them will not come back. If you turn them down a second time, half of those won't come back. And if they apply a third time, they probably really need it, so go ahead and grant it.
How true, how true. So you would agree that there might be something. Let's sit here and see how complicated we can make the process so that a lot of these guys would just go away.
The law says that in case of a doubt, the benefit of the doubt is to go to the veteran. But a lot of those who have to make the decision don't do that. Now let's say you were in Cambodia at a time we were not supposed to be there, and you were injured while in Cambodia. It doesn't count because there's no certification in your file that says you were in Cambodia.
Exactly.
Now I researched the law thoroughly, and I broke the process down into three steps. Number one, the law says you have to show you have a disabling injury. Number two, you have to show that that injury was caused and or exacerbated by your military service. And number three, you have to show that in fact you are it's not going to go away.
Quick question on number one, a disabling injury. When you state, and this is for legal clarification, when you state a disabling injury, that means that you are no longer able to do what in more precise terms? Basic life functions like brushing your teeth in the morning or showering or doing other biological necessities?
That is one definition. Under the veterans regulations, I knew an individual who broke his lower leg. And after that, whenever it would rain, he had hurt like hell.
Right.
That got him a 20% disability rating. Now, at 20%, I think he gets a check every month for $200 or $300.
Okay.
But let's take it a step further. Let's say you were one of those who was exposed to Agent Orange. We know Agent Orange causes birth defects in children.
Right.
But let's say you can't prove you dealt with it. A friend of mine used to help mix it, putting it into the tanks on the planes. But he was detailed to that job. He was actually assigned to something else. So his medical record and his military record don't show any exposure to Agent Orange.
So he doesn't qualify to get benefits then because of that.
That's correct. However, something the law allows that very few people understand what it means, you can submit lay evidence to support your position. What is lay evidence? I knew that you were assigned to that unit. I can write you an affidavit. Let's say you know the pilot of one of the planes, and you still know him now that you're out of the military, and he knew that you helped do something to his plane. He may not have known what it was, but he can write you an affidavit. And that lay evidence must be accepted just like medical information.
That sounds like corroborating evidence to me, which can be subject to hearsay, possible distortions.
It can. However, the VA must then disprove it or give you the benefit of the doubt.
Okay. Good luck in disproving it. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good for the veteran.
Yeah. No. Yeah. 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 No. That's true. Ken, let me go back to the primer for just a second. What? Because you obviously dedicated a lot of time to really just manufacturing this primer, which is basically just trying to sell holistically the whole idea of how to get through the morass. And that's the only word that comes to mind with the VA. What makes the primer so practical?
Because it puts it in plain old ordinary English. It tells you how to do the forms. It tells you what forms to use. There are people that I've run into who don't even know they're entitled to veterans benefits. Because during the briefing in the out-processing briefing in the military, apparently they were dozing or they had some of the duty they had to do. I lay it, that book is about 500 pages, and I lay it out chapter and verse. If you'll look on your DD-214, you're going to see a series of codes, and they're going to tell you, you don't even know what those say. That book tells you what those codes are.
Good for you. Good for you, because, I mean, it's the VA is out to overwhelm veterans and discourage them in every possible way. You know, I was just wondering, how does applying for a veteran's benefits compare to understanding the IRS tax codes? I'd say almost
similar.
The VA is, sounds worse than the IRS tax codes.
But keep in mind, it's not the VA. It's those who are there supposedly to carry out what the VA was created to do, and that's to care for the veteran. I had an individual, a regional director. My congressman arranged for me to have a meeting with him. We get to the meeting, and the regional director, I thought I was going to be the only one there, but there were about 8 or 10 of us. And he was there with a bunch of his people. Now, I had been assured I'd meet with the director. And the first words out of his mouth, you know, I'm a very important person, and I can't be bothered with veterans, so you're going to meet with my staff, and they'll tell me what you said. And everybody said, well, yeah, okay. And I said, not just no, but hell no. I came to meet with you. You get to a point when nicety needs to go out the window. And I just told the guy, I was between him and a door. I was as big as he was. I came to meet with him, and I wasn't going to meet with anybody else. And he looked at me for a minute, and he said, okay, fine. I'll meet with you, but the rest of you are going to meet with my staff. And then he sat there and was the most condescending individual I have ever tried to deal with in my life. Yeah. I'd given him an entire stack of between the front door and the bottom floor of the hospital where I was going to meet with him. I picked up every application I could find and filled it out. I'm told that one of the ones I turned in was for rape counseling. But I gave him that whole stack of stuff, and he just looked at it and kind of shrugged. And, I mean, he was extremely condescending. Now, my wife had asked to come. She said, promised she wouldn't say a word, and I believed her. And about 10 minutes into it, she just erupted and had him back in the corner shaking her finger in his face and just chewing his butt out. And he was going, Abba, Abba, Abba. And I had to literally pick her up and drag her from the room.
Yeah.
The next day, I get a phone call on my cell phone from him. I had not given him the number. I don't know where he got it, probably from the congressman. And he said, look, I'll grant every single thing you ask for. I said, when? He said, right now. And I said, you don't have the authority. He said, yes, I do. I said, the board has to grant it. And he said, no, the board acts in my name. It's my authority they're using. And I checked it out, and he was correct. He said, I'll give you everything you've asked for if you drop your claim against the government. And you come out here to the VA and sign a contract with me. And he said, the other stipulation you must agree to besides dropping your complaint is I never have to lay eyes on your wife again. And I said, I can't guarantee that, but I'll agree to it. So I get out to the VA. Yeah. And he had just left for the airport. And I said, you people lie when a truce in your favor. And they said, no, no, don't get upset. Sign this document right here. There was a handwritten contract. He said, we have a courier going to take it to Waco. I signed it. This was on a Friday. Monday about 1:30, I get a phone call from a guy in Waco who said, look, we've granted everything that you asked for. I said, oh, okay. And he said, and they granted me now, this is what trips up a lot of veterans. They get given what's called unemployability, which gets you paid at 100% disabled level. Unemployability gets you the money and the medical treatment. It doesn't get you a lot of the other benefits.
Yeah.
Because your true rating may only be 60%. And he said, well, you asked us for
something. Here's the problem, because a lot of people then don't understand the language all that well.
Exactly.
And that's probably what makes your primer almost an invaluable instrument, because it allows people to understand exactly what the trickery behind the language is really trying to hide.
Just like going to a foreign country, you have to speak the language. And that book takes the VA speak and turns it into English.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, he went on to say, now I know you're going to be upset because we can't grant everything you asked for. But before you say anything, we're going to reevaluate your case and see if we can convert your unemployability to straight 100%. I was willing to say, okay, fine, you know, don't give me that stuff. But I said, okay, how many years is this going to take? And he said, can you give us till Friday? He called me back on Friday and said, okay, you're now 100%.
Yeah.
Back on track.
But you know, Ken, this thing, this situation with this gentleman that you were talking about, and somebody has to write the blueprint to all of this, whether it's this guy or his staff or some. They sit there and write out the entire blueprint in a way to overwhelm and marginalize the veteran. And that's where your primer comes in, because it cuts through a lot of that forest that a lot of people just don't know how to navigate through those kinds of waters. But let me cut out and just take another quick break here, and we'll be right back with Ken Hudnall and Veteran Benefits, a practical primer that's very, very needed in just a moment. Okay, and we are back once again with Mr. Ken Hudnall discussing tonight's topic, Veteran Benefits, a practical primer. Ken, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I do want to ask you one or two more things about your extraordinary experience, not only in the military, but okay. also exercising your bravery out in the battlefield. But I wanted to bring up an old history point, the Bonus Army. If you recall, the Bonus Army was a huge issue that came forward in American society during post-World War I years, throughout the latter part of the 1920s, about veterans being denied by the federal government a payment owed to them. And the veterans, if I recall the issue clearly enough, were asking for payments at a time when they desperately needed it the most, and that was, of course, during the years of the Depression. The federal government, of course, That's turned right. them down, knowing how much they were suffering, and yet the federal government still said no until all hell broke loose. And, of course, as we know, a lot of rioting and fighting took place, which the Army finally ended up pushing them across the Potomac. But the point is that the federal government finally ended up yielding to their demand and disseminating payments in two or three different parts. The point of bringing the Bonus Army issue up, Ken, is because how does the veteran today continue to suffer that stereotype, the man currently in the military today?
Well, Iraq is a prime example. A lot of the I forget what they call it these days. It used to be called the Iraq syndrome. A lot of very healthy soldiers suddenly became physical wrecks. And the VA said, well, there was nothing to cause it. It's got to be psychological.
Okay.
You know, a lot of people had been downwind of the destruction of several of Saddam's weapons bunkers. Nobody really knows what was in them. But these people are sick not because of something in their mind, but because something physically is wrong, and the VA literally turned their backs on them. Now that has been rectified, but it hadn't been all that long ago. If you can show that you have symptoms off a laundry list, then you are given benefits. Now, the problem is, what does how do you treat this problem that many of the doctors still think is all in your mind?
Yeah, and they stuff you with all sorts of medicines that, you know, can maybe help you but hurt you oftentimes more than it does help you.
Yeah, that's quite true.
Yeah,
and there's very few people afraid to stand up and you know, square off with the VA for fear of losing their benefits. They don't understand that once granted, they're yours.
Yeah. Ken, one final question, and I think that's almost all the time that we have. And I fell short because I would go easily another hour with you in just talking about veteran situations that they face today. But, you know, everybody likes to go out to a movie now and again, if for no other reason than just to get away from the ugly reality that many times prevails and hugs at our elbows every day. Are there any movies out there, old or new, which you would endorse for their depiction of the military and the veterans in it?
Well, one of the ones that I liked, and I'm sure there was a lot of build up that probably was overblown was Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah.
Now, I worked with, you know, a lot of the special forces and SEALs. I was never a member of them. I kept getting assigned to them for some reason. And a lot of what they talked about was relatively realistic. I mean, some of the bizarre things that happen in the military, you would think are science fiction, but they're not. And that's the closest I've seen to to certain aspects of reality.
No. No. Okay. All right. Good. Good choice. Good recommendation. And I'm afraid that at this time, that's all the time we have in the show for this evening. Thank you so much, Ken, for sharing your time and being a guest in tonight's show and leaving us with a new insight and a renewed appreciation for the plight of American veterans, a real kind of hero among us that we so often overlook. Thank you, Ken, very much.
Quite welcome.
And now we've come to the final part of our show where I wish to leave all of you with a final thought to consider and to further reflect regarding the signs of our times. Some final thoughts. Someone in the neighborhood has just come back from protecting you in a fight. And after having him take a couple of hard knocks for you, you then decide to ignore him and put him aside for a while. But only until you need him again to protect you. But by that time, he'll be too old to fight as hard as he used to when he was young. This is what veterans do. And just as they looked out for you as soldiers, now you must look out for them as veterans. We may think they don't matter because they've already done their military service and are now ready to draw on their pensions to drink, remain jobless, and feel victimized by the government. If our vets have taken this turn for the worse, it's only because we've decided long ago to shape and to provide a civil environment upon their return, designed to offer them nothing to come back to, like useless parts that have no function or practical purpose in society any longer. And don't talk to me about scarcity or short supply for our vets. Opportunities are made for veterans, because they bring a lot of skill and experience to the workplace, because they provide new insights for others to gain from, and because they add to our ledger of leverage to outcompete those vying for our foreign interests as well. It's democracy. It's our legacy. It's our responsibility. And it's about our civility that separates us as Americans from the rest of the world. So the next time you think that veterans don't matter, think again. Think about your own personal inadequacy. For it is only your dysfunctional distortion of reality and opportunity that drives you, that even rivets you, to subscribe to the notion that veterans, in all that they bring and represent, are not worth their keep. You think again and look out, for in the most unexpected of moments in this life of ours, where the unexplainable can suddenly turn on its head and become the new normal platform for rationality, a veteran may one day save your life, heaven forbid, from another Boston bombing. Join me again next Tuesday night at 9 p.m. for another hour of insight by visiting my website at bbsradio.com/historyandyou. And also please remember to visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube links found on the website as follow-ups to each and every program. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling, wishing all of you a very, very pleasant evening.